darkness and humanity, in a place that I had turned brutish and bloody. A few feet away, a guard sat, his body ostensibly half turned away from us, providing a semblance of privacy. This particular one was Jaiska. He had a family, and his mustaches were long for his three sons, all of whom had followed him into the guards. Decent enough, and willing to give us a little privacy as we whispered to each other through the bars. Not like Isaac, who loved to regale me with the executions he had seen, thanks to my inventions. Isaac said that within the gates of Chaim, no householder passed untested by the Balanthust. Heads not only decorated the city gates, but also the broad bridge that leaped the Sulong and now linked Chaim with its lesser kin. There were so many heads that the mayor had gotten tired of mounting trophies and now simply ordered bodies tossed into the river to float to the sea. "How is Jiala?" I asked.
"Better than you," Pila said. "She thrives and grows. Skax still refuses to let me bring her, but she is well. You can trust that. Skax is evil, but he loves your work, and so he cares for us."
"Other people's heads, in exchange for keeping our own."
I stared at my workshop.
"How many now have I killed? How much blood is on my hands?"
"It's no use thinking about. They were using magic, which was always forbidden. These are not guiltless people who go to the executioner's axe.
Don't forget that we were among them as well. Are among them, thanks to Skax.
There's no use thinking on it. It will only drive you mad."
I looked at her bitterly. "I've been here for 2 years already, and if I haven't found refuge in madness yet, I doubt I will." She sighed.
"In any case, it's slowing now. There are fewer who test the mayor's powers of detection."
She leaned close.
"Some say that he now only finds magic on people who are too wealthy or powerful.
Those ones he snuffs out and confiscates their families and property. And no one fights."
"A few, but he has supporters. The farmers near the Bramble Wall say the vines have slowed. In places, they even cut it back. For the first time in generations, they cut it back."
I scowled. We could have cut back miles if the mayor had simply used the Balanthust as it was intended.
"It's no use thinking on."
She pushed a cloth-wrapped bundle of bread through the bars.
"Here," she said, "please, eat a little."
But I shook my head and walked away from her offering. It was a petty thing. I knew it even as I did so, but there was no one else to lash out against. A petty rebellion for the real rebellion I had no stomach for. Pila sighed. I heard a rustling, and then her words to Jaiska.
"Give these to him when he changes his mind. Some for you as well. Don't let him starve himself."
And then she was gone, leaving me with my workshop and my killing devices. "Don't scorn her," Jaiska said. "She stands by you and your daughter when she could walk away easy. Old Skax likes to bother her. Comes and bothers her." I turned. "What do you mean?" He shrugged. "Bothers her. She doesn't say so." "Not to you. Wouldn't want you to do something stupid."
I sighed, feeling childish for my display. "I don't deserve her."
Jaiska laughed. "No one deserves anyone. You just win him, and hope you can hang on to him." He offered me the bread. "Might as well eat while it's fresh."
I took the bread and cut a slice on the work table. Cut one for him as well. The scent of honey and rosemary, along with the reek of neem and mint and the burn of coals from my glass fire.
"It's a strange world we live in," I said, waving at my work table. "All that time spent trying to find magic. And now, suddenly Skax asks for Balanthusts to kill Bramble again. Maybe he'll finally decide to cut away the Bramble Wall." Jaiska snorted. "Well, in a way."
He took a bite of bread and spoke around the mouthful.
"He cuts new lands into the Bramble for his and the mayor's friends. The people who inform for them. The favored guards. Are you going to get new lands? Jaiska shrugged. I'm just a sword. Keep my head down. Don't work magic when the hunters are out. Hope my sons all earn their sword swinging right. Don't need lands. Don't need honors. Don't do traffic with the mayor. I grimaced. That's wisdom there. I, on the other hand, thought I'd be a savior of our land. Brambles mostly stopped, Jaiska said. Hardly anyone except Skax uses magic anymore. Not in any real way. Can't remember the last time I saw Bramble sprouting in the upper city. We're saved. In a way. It isn't the way I hoped. Jaiska laughed at that. For being so clever with the devices, you're a damn silly-headed bastard. Pila said something similar to me once. Because it's true, alchemist. At the new voice, Jaiska leapt to his feet. No offense, sir. Skax swept into view. Go find something to do, guardsman. Grace, Jaiska touched his brow and fled. Skax sat down on the stool that Jaiska vacated. His gaze came to rest on Pila's gift. I'd ask you for some of that lovely bread, but I'm afraid you'd put bramble threads in it. I shook my head. Bramble threads would be too good for a creature like you. Ah, yes, a creature. Indeed. He smiled. A powerful creature, actually. Thanks to you. The most powerful magister in the land, now. The magisters of Alakan all have their heads fitted to spikes. He sighed. It really is an addiction. The feel of power flowing through. No one understands that. Siren song for those of us who have the knack. But then you already knew that. I don't miss it, I said. Skax snorted. Maybe, but the lure is certainly there. For many, for most. We could never allow the people to believe that your Balanthust was actually a solution. False comfort there. As soon as they sipped a little magic from the pool, they would have demanded to drink deep. And then, he made a motion with his hands, willy-nilly, everyone would have been spelling here and there, charming and spelling and making flying carpets, and we'd all have a lovely time, until the bramble overwhelmed us. It wouldn't have, I said. We're not stupid. Skax laughed. It's not as if the people of Janpra, of all the old empire, were unaware of magic's unfortunate effects. From the historical manuscripts, they tried mightily to hold back their base urges, but still they thirsted for magic. For the power, some. For the thrill. For the convenience. For the salvation. For the wonderful luxury. He made another motion, and a castle appeared above his hand, glowing. It floated in clouds, with dragons of every color circling it. How could anyone give this up? He asked. The people of Janpra had no discipline. Even the ones who wished to control themselves lacked the necessary will, and so our empire fell. In Skax's hand, the castle tumbled from its clouds and crashed into deep bramble forests that appeared below. Bramble spread over arched palaces, over colosseums, over temples to the three faces of Mara, growing tall and terrible. Dust and rubble clouds obscured the scene as more cloud castles fell. Skax brushed his hands together, obliterating the scene and knocking off a rain of dust that landed on his robes. Magic brings bramble, he said. And even you, alchemist, hungered to use it. Only a little. To save my daughter. Every spellmaker has a reasonable excuse. If we grant individual mercies, we commit collective suicide. A pretty puzzle for an ethical man like you. You think we're the same, then? Magic is magic. Bramble is bramble. I couldn't care less what hairs a philosopher splits. Now, every night, I sleep knowing that Bramble will no longer encroach. So I sleep very well indeed.
He stood, nodded at my new balanthust.
Hurry with your new device, alchemist. As always, your daughter's well-being depends upon it.
Why not let me go?
Why would I do such a thing? Then you might carry this knowledge of balanthusts to some other city. Perhaps give others the illusion that discipline is no longer needed.
He shook his head.
No, that would not do at all.
Chaim is my home, I said. I have no wish to leave. I could construct legions of balanthusts. You say you want to cut back the bramble now. At last, our goals align.
Our goals already align, alchemist.
Skax turned away.
Hurry with your tools.
I have fiefs I wish to disperse.
And if I refuse?
Skax turned back.
Then I simply will stop caring whether your daughter coughs up that river of blood of hers. The choice is yours.
It always has been. You'll never let me go.
Skax laughed. I can't think why I would. You're far too useful.
That night I lay in my bed, surrounded by the weirdly comfortable smells and drips of my prison workshop, turning the problem of the Magister over in my head. I could not bargain with the dragon mind of Skax, and despite his words, I suspected my time was running out. Building balanthusts to create bramble fiefdoms was not the green grass of a new beginning, but the signal smoke of a bitter end. Once a brigade of balanthusts was prepared, there would be no more need of me. I lay listening to the night guard's snores, and began to plan, assembling pieces and components into a larger whole. Not a plan fully formed, but still an intrigue, a tangle of misdirection, and at the end of its winding way, a path, perhaps, out of my Halzakian box. I considered the alleys and angles, testing chinks in the armor of my logic. If I was honest, there were many. But Pila, Jala, and I had already lived too long in the center of Chaim's bloody vortex. The storm would eventually tear us to pieces as well. Skax might be a man of his word, but he was not a man of charity. The mayor and Skax thought in terms of trade, and when I had nothing left to offer, they would do away with me. In the morning, I was up and constructing. Jaiska, I said, go find Skax. Tell him I've had an inspiration. When Skax appeared, I made my proposal. If you let me walk outside occasionally, I will make your detectors more powerful. I can extend their reach considerably, I think, and build them so that a man need not even handle them. They could run continuously, in market squares, all along the thoroughfares, at city gates. Skax looked at me suspiciously. Why so amenable, all of a sudden? I want to live well. I want to see the sun and the sky, and I'm willing to bargain.
You think to escape?
From a great magister like you.
I shook my head.
I have no illusions. But I cannot live forever without fresh air. I held up an arm. Look at me. I'm wasting away. Look how pale I become. Shackle me how you like, but I would breathe fresh air.
How will you improve your design?
Here. I rolled out parchment and dipped my quill. Scratched out the bones of a design. It would be a bit like a torch standing. A sentry. It would issue a slow smoke from its boiler. Anyone who walked near would be caught. I pushed the rough sketch through the bars.
You've been holding this back.
I met Skax's gaze. You should realize that keeping me alive and happy has benefits. Skax laughed at that, liking the bargain he thought we were making.
Does your hold on survival feel tenuous, alchemist? I want assurances, Skax. And a life. A life better than this.
Oh? There's something else you desire.
I want Pila to be able to pass evenings with me again.
Skax leered, then shook his head. No, I think not.
Then I will not improve your detectors.
I could torture you.
I looked at him through the bars. You have all the power, Magister. I ask for a favor, and you return with threats. What else can I offer you? A better balanthust as well? Something that works faster and better than the ones you currently have?
I can design ones that are light and portable.
They could clear fields in days. Imagine the magics you could wield if Bramble was hardly a threat at all.
And the hook was set. After all, what good is it to be the finest magister in the land, when you cannot wield the finest, most impressive magics? Skax's hunger to use his powers chafed against the natural limits that Bramble imposed.
And so I set to work on my newly conceived balanthusts and my detectors, my workroom filled with supplies, with copper rolls, with bellows and tongs, with brass and nails, glass bulbs and vacuum tubes. And Skax came to visit daily, eager for my promised improvements. And Pila came to visit as well. In the darkness, we clutched close, and I murmured into her ear.
This cannot work, she whispered.
If it does not, you must go without me, I said.
I won't. It will do no good.
Do you love Jala?
Of course I do.
Then you must trust me. Trust me as much as you did when I labored for so many years to get us into this mess.
It's madness.
A madness I created. And I must stop it. If I cannot, you must run. Take the spell for Jala's health and go. Run as far as you can. For if I fail, Skax will pursue you to the very ends of the earth. In the morning, Pila left with a kiss and a copper token of my affection bound around her wrist, a little bit of the workshop, leaving with her. Over the course of weeks, I worked feverishly, and at night, I met with Pila and whispered formulas and processes in her ear. She listened close, her long black hair tickling like feathers on my lips, the lustrous strands cloaking us as we played at intimacy and worked at salvation. My detectors went up in the city, gouting out foul smoke and blanketing Chaim in their reactants, and once again blood ran in the streets. Skax was well pleased. He granted me the privilege of letting me out of my cage. I was so unfit that I ran out of breath simply walking up the stairs out of the dungeon. And then I gasped again when we reached the grounds and gazed over the city. The flames of the detectors glowed here and there, blue fireflies sending out scented smoke that clung to anything magical at all. The bridge to Lesser Chaim blazed astonishingly bright, a beacon of magic in the thickening darkness.
You have wrought something beautiful, Skax said. Chaim will always be known as the Blue City now. And from now on, we will grow.
He pointed into the sky, and I could see where the beginnings of a castle clung to wisps of accumulating clouds. I sucked in my breath in astonishment.
It's damnably difficult to summon and collect the clouds, Skax said. But it will be quite pretty when it's completed.
I felt as if I was staring at fabled Jandpra. I could almost hear the music and taste the joy of Mount Sena wine I had quaffed so long ago. When I found my voice, I said, You must bring the old balanthusts back to me, so that I can adjust them. I will have to trade out their combustion chambers for the power that they will now wield.
Skax smiled and rubbed his hands together. And then I will truly be able to set to work on my castle. I won't have to check my powers at all.
The Magister of the Blue City, I said.
Indeed.
I'd very much like to see it when it's done. Skaggs looked over at me, thoughtful. If these Balanthusts perform as you describe them, alchemist, then the very least I can do for you is to give you a domicile above the earth. A prison in the air? Better than one on the ground. You will have a most astonishing view. I laughed at that. I won't argue. In fact, I will hurry the moment. I turned to leave, but then paused, voicing an afterthought. When the Balanthusts arrive, I'll also need several pots of bramble to test and make sure my designs are correct. Skaggs nodded, distracted, still staring up at the triumph of his castle. What's that? Bramble, I said patiently. For the testing. Skaggs waved an acknowledgement, and the guards led me back down to my dungeon. Weeks later, I asked Chaiska to summon Skaggs for the final demonstrations. I'd lined up a number of bramble plants in pots. It would work better if we were at the bramble wall, I grumbled, but this should suffice. Along one wall, I had all the Balanthusts of the city lined up, each one newly altered, its delivery tubes and chambers reshaped to their improved purpose. I took one of the gleaming instruments from its rank and plunged its nozzle into the bramble pot. The bramble's limbs quivered malevolently, as if it understood the evil I planned for it. The dry pods rattled as the pot shifted. I lit the match and pressed it into the new combustion chamber. Much faster and easier to ignite now. A low explosion. The plant thrashed briefly, and then disappeared in a puff of acrid smoke. There was simply nothing left of it at all. I laughed, delighted. You see? Skaggs and Jaiska stared, dumbfounded. I did it again, laughing. And now Skaggs and Jaiska laughed as well. Well done, alchemist. Well done. And it is prepared much more quickly now, I said. These chambers on top mix the ingredients so that they are always at the ready. Open this valve and... I lit another match. Explosion. Vented smoke. The potted bramble soaked up the Balanthust's poison and disappeared in a squeal of burning sap and writhing smoke. I grinned. Did it again and again, working something greater than magic in my workshop. Jaiska stamped his feet and whistled. Skaggs's smile widened into a greedy, astonished grin. And then I, laughing and in my folly, drunk on my success, grabbed a bramble with my bare hands. A silly, reckless thing. A moment of inattention, and all my genius was destroyed. I yanked my hand away as if the bramble was on fire, but its thread-like hairs clung already to my bare skin. The sleeping toxins numbed my hands, spreading like fire. I fell to my knees, tried to stand, stumbled and crashed into the Balanthust, tumbling it and knocking it over, shattering it. Fool! Skaggs shouted. I tried to get up once more, but fell back instead, tangling with bramble again. Its thorns pricked me. Its threads clung to my skin, poisoning, clutching and hungry for me, burrowing sleep into my heart, pressing down upon my lungs. Darkness closed on my vision. It was terrifyingly fast. I crawled away, stupid with the toxins, reached through the bars. Skaggs and Jaiska shied from my thread-covered hands. Please, I whispered. Use your magic. Save me. Skaggs shook his head, staying well away from my touch.
No magic works against Bramble's sleep.
Please, I croaked. Giala, please, keep her well.
Skaggs looked at me with contempt. There's really no point now, is there? My limbs turned to water. I slumped to the flagstones, still reaching through the bars as he went blurry and distant. The Magister stared down at me with a bemused expression.
It's probably better this way, alchemist. We would have had to chop your head off, eventually.
He turned to Jaiska.
As soon as he's done thrashing, gather up the Balanthasts, and don't be so stupid as he was.
What about his body? Should I take him to his wife?
No. Dump it in the river with the rest.
I was too far gone to panic. Bramble stilled my heart.
7.
Having my flesh burned with blue flame is not my preferred method to awaken, but it is a great improvement over death. Another gust of flame washed over me.
It burned through my blood, blistered my lungs, tunneled about in my heart, and dragged me back to life.
I writhed in the heat, trying to breathe. Another blast of flame. And suddenly, I was coughing and wheezing. My skin burned, but I breathed.
Stop!
I croaked, waving weakly for mercy, praying I wouldn't be scoured again. I opened my eyes. Pila crouched over me, a fantastic, jeweled Balanthast in her hands. Jala stood beside her, worried, clutching at her skirt.
Are you alive, Papa?
She asked. I pushed myself upright, shaking bramble threads from my arms. Pila looked me over, brushed me with a gloved hand.
He's alive enough, child. Now hurry and get our things. It's time for us to run.
Jala nodded obediently and ran out of my workroom. I stared after her, astonished. How she had grown. Not a small child at all, but tall and vital. So much change in the years I had been imprisoned. Pila continued to brush away the singed bramble thread. I winced at her touch.
Don't complain, she said. Blisters mean you're alive.
I flinched away from another round of brushing.
You've found my body, it seems.
It was a near thing. I was expecting a coffin to arrive. If Jaiska hadn't been decent enough to send word of where you'd been dumped, she shrugged. You were nearly tossed into the water with the rest of the corpses before I found you.
Help me stand.
With her support, I made it to my feet. My old familiar workshop, but altered under Pila's influence. I had to replace much of the equipment, Pila explained as she braced me upright. Even with your instruction, it was an uncertain thing.
I'm alive, though.
I looked at her Balanthast. My design, but her construction. Noticing places where she had made changes. She held it by a leather strap that she slung over her shoulder.
You've made it quite portable,
I said admiringly. If we're to run, it's time we did.
More than time.
In the hall, our last belongings were stuffed into wicker baskets with harnesses to hold them upon our backs. A tiny pile of essentials. So little of my old life. A few wool blankets, food and water jugs. And yet, there also, Pila and Jala. More than any man had any right to ask for. We slung our baskets, and I groaned at the weight in mine.
Easy living, Pila commented. Jala could carry more than you.
Not quite that bad, I hope. In any case, nothing that a long walk won't fix.
We ducked out into the streets, the three of us together, winding through the alleys. We ran as quickly as we could for the gates of Chaim, making our way towards the open fields. Inside, I felt laughter and relief bubbling up. My skin was burned, my hair was matted and melted, but I was alive, maybe for the first time in almost 20 years. And then the wind shifted, and a cloud of smoke blew across us. One of my own infernal detectors, now standing sentry on every street. Jala lit up like an oil lamp. Pila sucked in her breath. She was only treated yesterday. The magic still shows. Normally I kept her in after Skak spelled her. Quick as a cat, we swept a cloak over Jala, smothering the blue glow, and yet still it leaked out. Jala's face shone an unearthly shade. I picked her up and buried her face in my chest. She was heavy.
Don't show your skin, child.
We slunk through the city and out into the fields as darkness fell. We went along the muddy road, trying to hide my daughter's fatal hue, but it was useless. Farmers on the road saw and gasped and dashed away, and even as we hurried forward, we heard cries behind. People who sought to profit from turning in a user of magic.
"We aren't going to make it," Pila said. "Run, then."
And we did, galloping and stumbling. I panted at the unaccustomed exercise. I was not meant to run, not after years in prison. In a minute I was gasping. In two, spots swam before my vision, and I was staggering. And still we ran, now with Jala on her own, tugging at me, dragging me forward, healthier by far than I. Behind us the shouts of guardsmen echoed. They gained. Ahead, black bramble shadows rose.
"Halt!" the guard shouted. "In the name of Caim and the mayor!"
On the run, Pila fired her balanthast, lit its prime, prepared to plunge it into the ground at the bracken root.
"No!" I gasped. "Not like that!"
I lifted the device so it pointed into the guts of the bracken.
"Don't hurt the roots, just the branches."
Pila glanced at me, puzzled, then nodded sharply. The balanthast roared. Blue flame lanced from the nozzle, igniting the branches. Bramble writhed and vaporized, opening a deep, narrow corridor of smoking, writhing vines. We plunged into the gap. Another shout came from behind.
"Halt!"
An arrow thudded into a bramble branch. Another creased my ear. I grabbed Jala and forced her low as Pila fired the balanthast again. Behind us, the guardsmen were stumbling across the tilled fields, splashing through irrigated trenches. Their swords gleamed in the moonlight. Blue flame speared the night again, and a writhing path in the bramble opened before us. I pulled out the spell book of Magister Arun.
"A match, daughter!"
I struck the flame and handed it to Jala. In its flickering, unsteady light, I read spidering text by the hand of that long-dead magister. A spell for sweeping. A dust devil formed in the bracken, swirling. I waved my hand and sent it spinning down the narrow way behind us. A simple spell. A bit of household magic for a servant or a child. Nothing in comparison to the great works of Janpra. But to the bramble all around, that tiny spell was like meat tossed before a tiger. The vines shivered at magic's scent and clutched after my sweeping whirlwind. I cast more small spells as Pila opened a way ahead. Bramble closed in behind, starving for the magic that I scattered like breadcrumbs, ravenous for the nurturing flavors of magic cast so close to its roots. Vines erupted from the earth, filling the path and locking us in the belly of the bramble forest. Behind us, the guards' shouts faded and became indistinct. A few more arrows plunged into the bramble, ricocheting and clattering, but already the vines were thick and tangled behind us. We might as well have been behind a wall of oak. Pila fired the balanthast again, and we moved deeper into the malevolent forest.
"We won't have long before they follow us."
I shook my head. "No, we have time. Skaxis balanthasts will not work. I crippled them all before I left, when Skax thought I was improving them. Only the one I used for my demonstration worked, and I made sure to shatter it."
"Where are we going, Papa?" Jala asked.
I pulled Jala close as I whispered another spell of dust and tidying. The little whirlwind whisked its way into the darkness, baiting bramble, closing the path behind us. When I was done, I smiled at my daughter and touched her under her chin. "Have I ever told you of the copper mines of Kesh?"
"No, Papa."
"They are truly wondrous. Not a bit of bramble populates the land, no matter how much magic is used. An island in a sea of bramble." The blue fire of Pila's balanthast again lit the night, sending bramble writhing away from us, opening a corridor of flight. I picked up Jala, still amazed at how heavy she had become in my years away, but unwilling to let her leave my side, even for a moment, welcoming her truth and weight. We started down the corridor that Pila had opened. Jala gave a little cough and wiped her lips on her sleeve. "Truly?" she asked. "There is a place where you can use magic, even for my cough." "As sure as Balanthus," I told her, and hugged her tight. "We only have to get there." Another blast of blue flame lit the night, and we all forged onward.
Part 2. The Executioness by Tobias S. Bakel. 1. Let me tell you about the first time I killed a man. On the morning of that day, my father Anto lay on the simple straw-stuffed mattress that I'd dragged out to the kitchen fire, choking on his own life as a wasting sickness ate at him from the inside. He had been like this for days now. I'd watched him grow thin, watched him cough blood, and listened to him swear at the gods in a steady mumble, which I struggled to hear over the crackle of the kitchen fire. I burned the fire to keep him warm, even though winters in Lesser Kaim were not the kind that kill men, like the ones far to the north. Winter was a cool kiss here in Lesser Kaim, and the fire kept him comfortable and happy in his last days. "Why haven't you fetched the healer yet, you useless creature?" my father hissed at me. "Because there are none to fetch," I said firmly, gathering my skirts around my knees to crouch by his side. I put a scarred hand, the sign of my long years of slaughtering animals at the back of the butcher's shop, to his forehead. It felt hot to my old calloused palms. There had been a healer in this neighborhood once, a wrinkled old man who lanced boils and prescribed poultices, but he'd fled the jolly mayor and his city guards when he'd crossed the bridge, and the smoke stained him bright blue. The old man had been lucky to flee with his life toward Pica, and the lands troubled by its raiders, though who knew how long he could live out there. "Then bring me someone who can cure me," my father begged. "It would be a small magic. I'm in so much pain." His pleading tore at me. I leaned closer to him and to the crackle of the fire, which burned wood we could barely afford in these times, when refugees from Alakan crammed themselves into Lesser Kaim, eating and using everything they could get their hands on. I sighed as I stood, my knees cracking with the pain of the movement. "Would you have me look for someone who can cast a spell for you, and then condemn us all to death when we turn blue from the Magister's smoke? It would be a heavy irony for anyone in this family to die at the blade of an executioner's axe, don't you think?" I thought, for a moment, that he considered this. But when I looked closely at his face for a reaction, I realized he'd sunk back into his fever. My father had returned to muttering imprecations at the gods in his sleep. A husk of a blasphemer, he took so much joy in seeing the pious void their bowels at the sight of his executioner's axe. This was the man who would lean close and whisper at the condemned through his mask, "Do you not believe you will visit the halls of the gods soon? Don't you burn favors for a god, perhaps one like Tuva, so that you will eat honey and milk from bowls that never empty, and watch and laugh at the struggles of mortals shown on the mirrors all throughout Tuva's hall? Or do you actually fear that this is truly your last moment of life?" That was my father, the profane. Unlike his outwardly pious victims, and despite his frequent irreverence, my father was a believer. He had to believe. He was an executioner. If there were no gods, then what horrible thing was it that he did? Now he was going to find out. It angered him that it was taking so long to slowly waste away into death, so he cursed the gods, especially the six-armed Borzai, who would choose which hall we would spend eternity in. My father swore at Borzai, even though he would soon meet the god. And even though that god would decide his afterlife, my father was not the sort of man who cared. He had no thoughts for the future, and he dwelled little on the past. I'd always admired that about my father, even though I hated much about his coarseness toward me. My oldest son, Jaram, peeked around a post to look into the kitchen, his dark curly hair falling down over his brown eyes. "Is he sleeping?" I nodded. "Are you hungry?" "I am," Jaram said. "So is Set, but he doesn't want to come down the stairs. He says it hurts." Set had been born with a twisted foot. "Stay quiet," I cautioned as I picked up a wooden platter. I spooned olives from a jar, tore off several large pieces of bread, cut some goat's cheese, and then lined the edges with figs. Jaram dutifully snuck back up the crude wooden stairs, and I heard the planks overhead creak as he took the food to his brother. Soon he would need to work for the family. But for now, I sheltered him in the attic with his brother and their toys. I wanted them both to have some peace before their worlds got harder, particularly Set's. I opened a window and looked outside. My husband, Jorda, was supposed to be working the field. Instead, he was sprawled under a gnarled tree, a wineskin lying over a blistered forearm. There was always a wineskin. Ever since he had run away from tending the sentinel braziers along the mayor's bridge, unable to scrub the sweet smell of neem and mint from his skin, or unsee the people dragged away, glowing blue and sobbing because of him. I never passed him a single copper earned from my butchering, but he still found wine. He usually begged them from his friends among the Alakan refugees. He'd sit with them and loudly damn the collapse of Alakan, and they'd cheer him and buy him cheap wine. With a sigh, I shut the wooden window. My father groaned and swore in his sleep, disturbed by the cold air. I would have liked to have had a healer here, someone who could give us bitter medicine and hope, a kind ear for the betrayals of the body. But for all that I may have hated the jolly mayor and his terrifying magister, my family's lives had depended on the mayor over the years. My life, my two sons, my husband, and my father. For my father, skinny, frail, over-tempered bastard and profaner that he was an executioner for Kaim and the mayor. We would have starved a long time ago without that money. The coin tossed in the executioner's cup by the soon-to-be beheaded, in hopes of buying a good cut. The coppers tossed into the bucket by the crowd, the mayor's retainer. So when the tiny bell by the door rang, it was with the authority of a thunderclap. The tiny note floated around the old house's timbers, dripping into the kitchen, and wrapping itself around me as its quivering tones faded. This was the first time it had rung, since Anto had fallen sick. My father was being summoned, as executioner, to bring his axe to the square by the highest of noon. Somewhere, across the inky shoving waters of the Sulong River that split Lesser Kaim and Kaim, and up on Malvia Hill and in the mayor's house, someone had rung the executioner's bell. The bell was magic, of course. The mayor swore that the spells that had been cast to create the bells had been formed a long time ago, and that the bells were safe. I wondered if that was true, as I could smell magic softly in the air by the doorway whenever the bell rang. It tasted of ancient inks, herbs, and spices, and it settled deep in the back of my throat. Once the executioner's bell was rung in the mayor's house, Dacre, the goddess of a thousand multiple roads and choices, dictated which executioner's bell rang back in sympathy, and Dacre had chosen ours. Dacre was well known for her tricks. The goddess of dice throwers was playing one last little one on my father. I looked back over my thick wooden kitchen table toward my father. His brown eyes were wide, his brows crinkled in intense thought. He rubbed his anemic mustache, which was a sign of his failure, that he had only ever had one child, and a daughter at that.
"The call," he said, voice breaking. "Tana, did you hear it?"
I moved to him. "You can't go. You know that." I wondered as I said it where the gentleness in my voice had come from. It had never been offered to me in my life by this old man. Not in all the years I'd cooked and chopped wood, or the long years I'd worked as a butcher.
"I know I can't go, you stupid girl," my father spat. "It is well beyond me."
The bell needed to be rung, if an executioner were here. In 5 minutes, if there was no reply, the call would go to someone else. In a way, that dying ring would signal the death of our family. Without my father's occasional income, we would have to sell the small house and the land, and then we would become little better than the refugees around us. I watched him lie back down onto the bed, gazing up at the thick ceiling beams.
"Where is Jorda?"
my father asked. "Sleeping," I said.
"Drunk,"
he spat.
"Weak, addled."
"Not everyone can see blood spilled as easily as you," I snapped at my father. His jaw set and he said,
"I have always answered the call. Always come back with the mayor's coin to keep us alive as the bramble creeps into our useless field. I'll slit my own throat right here and now before I hand over the executioner's bell. It is all that keeps my miserable bloodline flowing."
"What are you even talking about?" I asked. My father coughed.
"The gods hate me. Had I a son, he'd be on his way to answer the call already."
My voice jumped in anger. "Well, I'm not your son. I'm your daughter. You must live with that." And then I added,
"With what little life you do have left."
My father nodded.
"This is true. This is true."
And then he crawled out of his bed. The blanket slipped off to reveal his liver-spotted arms. "What are you doing?" I asked. He stumbled out of the kitchen to the door, stick-like legs quivering from the effort. I realized what he was about to do and moved to stop it, but with a last wily burst of energy, he staggered forward and rang the executioner's bell before I grabbed his arm. As the single clear note rang out and filled the back of my throat with the faint taste of old magic, he crumpled to the floor in a heap of bones and skin, laughing at me.
"Now you have to go in my place, daughter of mine. Now you have no choice. Jorda is drunk, Duram too young, and Set too crippled."
He panted where he lay, staring up at me with eyes sunk deep into wasted skeletal sockets.
"The mayor would execute both of us if you try to tell him what we just did. He is not a forgiving man. When you face Borzai in the Hall of Judgment, he will banish you to Takaz's torture cells for eternity," I told him. "When I hear your spirit groan in the night tortured by Takaz's demon wives, I will laugh and pretend I didn't hear it."
He flinched at that.
"Do you hate me so?"
I trembled with outrage.
"You bring me nothing but pain and drudgery and burden."
He thought on that for a long while. Longer than I'd seen him consider anything.
"You must go just this once, then. After this, you can turn the bell in. I'll be dead soon. I can't stop you. Yet you must at least cover the expense of my funeral. I'll not have my appearance in Borzai's Hall of Judgment delayed because the rites were not pleasing to him. And after that, if you wish it, it could be your trade. It is a good living, daughter. And with me gone, there will be one less body to care for, one less mouth to feed. You have no field, and butchering people will give you more than butchering pigs."
Then he sighed and crawled toward his bed. I said nothing. I helped him back to it, his body surprisingly light as I slung his arm over my neck. "How can I kill someone who has done nothing to me?" I asked. My father grunted.
"Don't look into their eyes. Consider that the mayor and his magister have a reason for their death. They glow blue. Remember that if they have led a proper life, they will be sent to the right hall for eternity."
"Won't the mayor's guards be able to tell I'm not you?"
"No," my father murmured. I've been wasting away long enough. I'm a small figure, so are you. Wear my hood, carry my axe, and none will be able to tell the difference. It's no different than chopping wood. Raise the axe, let it fall, don't swing it, and aim the edge for the neck. You've killed enough pigs. You can do this. And with that he slipped away to his sleep, exhausted by all his recent efforts. I understood he'd always wanted a son, that he'd wanted the farm to produce the crops it had when he was little, before the bramble grew to choke it. I understood that he never wanted me to marry Jorda. I understood that maybe he'd wanted to give me the bell a long time ago, but had been too scared to do it. Why else would he have begged and called in so many favors from old friends to make sure that I worked as a butcher? I walked through Lesser Kaim, dressed as an executioner. Inside, I was still me, Tana, weary and tired, struggling to see through the small slits in the leather hood over my face. I'd called Duram down before I'd left, and kissed him on his forehead. "What was that for?" he'd asked, puzzled. "Just know that I love you and your brother. I have to leave for an errand, but I will be back home soon." After I sent him back upstairs, I'd opened the cedar chest in my father's room and pulled out the black leather jerkin, hood, and heavy cape of his office. They fit me well enough as I pulled them on, as he had said they would. His canvas leggings slid off my waist, but a length of rope fixed that. The axe lay in the bottom of the chest, the curved edge of the blade gleaming in the light. It weighed less than it looked, and was well balanced in my hand, heavier than the axe I used to chop wood with, but not anywhere as heavy as I had somehow imagined. Now I rested the axe on my shoulder and walked through the cramped streets. The tight alleyways of Lesser Kaim gave way to the mud banks, stilt houses, and clumps of bramble along the river. I followed a fire crew along the stone steps toward the newly finished bridge. They wore masks and thick double-canvas clothing. As they walked, they pumped the primers on the back of their tanks, then lit the fires on the brass-tipped ends of their hoses. When they flicked the levers, fresh flame licked out across the bramble, threatening to creep over the stairs. Clumps of the thorny, thick creep withered under the assault. Clearers followed close behind, chopping at the bramble, careful not to touch any of it lest they get pricked. Children scampered around with burlap sacks to pick up bramble seeds. They stopped the burn when they saw me, and stepped aside to let me down the path leading toward the bridge that caused the very build-up they were burning back.
"If it's magic users you're sending to Borzai's judgment today," one of them called out from behind a mask as fearsome as mine, "then I salute you."
Others agreed in wordless grunts as they hacked at bramble with axes. The bridge across the river reared before me, the glowing sentinel braziers that Jorda had once tended, choking the air with spicy sweet herb scents. An ominous pall of smoke caused everyone to nervously glance at one another as they set foot on the magical structure, as if the bridge's furious blue glow would stain them as well. The heads of previous victims stared down upon us all as we crossed, eyes warning us of the horror that awaited those who trafficked in magic.
"It ain't those unlucky people with their petty spells causing the bramble creep," someone ahead of me muttered to a friend as he looked up at the heads. He jutted his chin up into the air. "There's the real abomination."
High above us, an unfinished castle hung in the air, the foundation resting upon wisps of cloud. The sharp smell of the magic holding the half-completed structure in the air wafted down toward the bridge. Strong, tangy, and dangerous.
"Mark me," the man said as we all stepped off the bridge and into Kaim. "We'll end up like Alakan, choked with bramble, and fleeing our city, if Skax keeps building that unholy thing."
But he said nothing about the magic holding up the bridge he had just crossed. I walked through Kaim, enjoying the taller marble and stone buildings and fluted columns,
Sentinel braziers glowed at every intersection, and people almost leaned against the walls to try to avoid the smoke. There were few braziers yet in Lesserkheim. At first they'd sprouted quickly, looming at every gate and market square, but of late their creation had slowed, perhaps for lack of materials, or maybe, as some whispered, because the jolly mayor had mostly been interested in eliminating his velvet rivals. But my relaxation faded as I watched people scuttle away before me in nervousness, and it fully vanished when I turned to the public square and the raised platform at the center, where the executions were held. Early crowds had already gathered. Vendors walked around selling flatbreads and fruits throughout the square. City guards waited on the lip at the top of the platform's steps. They waved me on impatiently, and I saw the figure shimmering blue in chains between them. He turned, saw me, and his knees buckled. The guards held him up under his arms and laughed. The jolly mayor himself came to the square and puffed his way up the stairs onto the platform with us. His beady eyes regarded me for only the briefest of seconds, then fixed on the blade. He smiled and moved closer.
"Make this a good one, eh, executioner?"
He chuckled before I could even think to ask what he meant, which was a good thing, as I wasn't sure I could reach for a deeper voice. I was far too nervous. The guards dragged the sobbing and retching prisoner up the stairs. They shackled him to the four iron rings on the floor of the platform, half bowed to the mayor, and then retreated. Chains tinkled as the prisoner moved, trying to look over his shoulder.
"Please, please, have you no mercy? My sheep were dying of mouth rot. My family would have starved."
The mayor did not look at the man, but instead at the crowd. He cried out for all to hear,
"Crime will not fall to the bramble, like the cities of the Empire of Junpera. Their failures guide us, and we call for the gods to forgive us for what we must do, which is to punish those who use forbidden magic, for they threaten every last one of us."
Then the mayor turned to me and waved his hand. A sound like a babbling brook came from the crowd. The murmur of 100 or so voices at once. Behind that I heard the shifting of chains and the sobbing of a doomed man. I imagined either of my two sons laid out like this, begging for forgiveness. I imagined my husband Jorda's scrawny body there, his burn-marked arms pulled to either side by the chains. I had to steady myself to banish these thoughts, so I wobbled a step forward. I raised the axe high, so that I would only need to let it fall to do its work. And as I did, the crowd quieted in anticipation. I let the axe fall. It swung toward the vulnerable nape of the man's neck as if the blade knew what it was doing. And then the man shifted, ever so slightly. I twisted the handle to compensate, just a twitch to guide the blade, and the curving edge of the axe buried itself in the man's back at an angle on the right. It sank into his shoulder and fetched up against bone with a sickening crunch. It had all gone wrong. Blood flew back up the handle across my hands and splattered against my jerkin. The man screamed. He thrashed in the chains, a tortured animal almost jerking the axe out of my blood-slippery hands.
"Gods, gods, gods," I said,
terrified and sick. I yanked the axe free. Blood gushed down the man's back and he screamed even louder. The crowd stared, anonymous oval faces hardly blinking. I raised the axe quickly and brought it right back down on him. It bit deep into his upper left arm, and I had to push against his body with my foot to lever it free. He screamed so loudly my ears rang, and I was crying as I raised the axe yet again.
"Boz, I will surely consider this before he sends you to your hall," I said, my voice scratchy and loud inside the hood.
I took a deep breath and counted to three.
I would not miss again. I would not torture this dying man any more.
I must imagine I am only chopping wood, I thought. I let the axe fall once more. I let it guide itself, looking at where it needed to be at the end of the stroke.